This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Yesterday on the program, we talked with a philosopher and an economist who both worried about fractures in our democracy that showed up during the recent government shutdown. A lot of our conversation was about ideology and how adhering to very narrow views for short-term political gain can help to break down the sense that we are all in this together. At the root of this problem, they found, is a concern that people just really aren't all that engaged in our democracy on a daily basis. Not enough of us vote or organize or even care about how civic structures work. This is especially a problem among young people. Today, Where We Live, a few ideas about how to solve the problem of youth civic engagement. Coming up, we'll hear from people involved in modeled UN programs, and we want you to join the conversation. Do you feel like you're civically engaged? 860-275-7266. Again, our phone number is 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive at wnpr.org. You can tweet us at wherewelive, and you can find our show online at wnpr.org. My first guest joins us from WGBH in Boston. He's Peter Levine. He's author of a new book called We Are the Ones We Have Been Waiting For, The Promise of Civic Renewal in America. He's from Tufts University and director of the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement. Thank you so much, Peter, for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
First of all, what do you think civic engagement really is?
At its heart, I think it's actually working with other people, including people we disagree with, mostly at the local level, to address and define public problems and actually try to solve them.
Can we measure how civically engaged we are right now in America? That's something you've been done. How exactly do you put a number to that?
Well, you know, it's imperfect, but we do ask survey questions about behaviors like that. So one that I like is a question, have you worked with neighbors to address a public problem? It's probably put a little bit better than that. But 7% of Connecticut residents said that they had done so in 2011, and that's pretty low. It's lower than the national average, by the way, which is a little surprising to me. And I think it's lower than it was in 20 or 30 years ago. So that is a symptom of a problem.
My goodness. So we're lower than the national average when it comes to working with our neighbors? That is a little bit surprising to me.
Right. I mean, for two reasons. One, because you've got a great old tradition of local government, and also because you're a relatively affluent state, and that kind of work tends to correlate with wealth and education. But so I would have sort of expected Connecticut to be higher. It's actually the 37th state in terms of working with neighbors.
So are we wrong to feel that the American public is less civically engaged than it used to be, or do the trends across America really bear this out?
Well, I come down on the conclusion that we are less engaged than we used to be. It's controversial, and people might want to think about it and talk about it, because there are new ways that we're engaged, which I'm pretty excited about, including online. So it's not all bad. And there are wonderful programs and projects that people are working on all across the country. But I do come down on the conclusion that things are worse than they were 20 or 30 years ago, not so much because we've lost our virtue or we don't care or anything like that, but because the structures that used to involve lots of Americans in civic work every day have really eroded.
When you say the structures have eroded, give me some examples of what that means.
Well, a whole lot fewer people are on school boards, for example, not because they don't want to be on school boards, but because we've tended to get rid of school boards or consolidate school districts so that there aren't really opportunities. Unions, of course, have pretty much collapsed. The old fraternal groups like the Lions and the Knights of Columbus have declined badly. And I wouldn't say what we need is just to restore them, because we need some 21st century equivalent, but I don't believe we've got the 21st century equivalent yet.
There's a reason that I hear from people all the time about why they might not be more interested in, say, serving on a school board, and it has to do with how we apportion our time in America these days. People just don't feel they have the time to do this. Is that something that you hear as you look at this issue, that people are saying, I'm just too busy in my life, I commute too far, I've got too much with my kids' soccer practice and my work to really be concerned about sitting on a school board?
Yeah, no, and I'm sympathetic to that. I think people are busy and busier than they used to be. Although we do find that people who work, including full-time, actually are more engaged than people who are retired or not working. I think sometimes work is actually an opportunity to find out about civic engagement. Plus, we should be thinking about ways to integrate civic engagement right into work. so that it's not all about your unpaid after-work activity, your 2 hours at the school board. It's also that as a teacher or a banker or anything, or a police officer, you have more opportunities to work with other people to address public problems.
If you want to join our conversation as we talk about civic engagement today on the show, 860-275-7266. If you're someone who does work with others in your community to make things better, we'd love to hear your story. If you're someone who feels as though you're not as civically engaged as you could be, we'd like to hear from you too, 860-275-7266. You measure the steady decline in civic engagement starting in the 1970s. You've talked already about whether or not people say they work on community projects with others. There's also the idea of just reading the newspaper, of gathering news about our world, and people are doing that less too.
Yes, and that's a great example of how it's not really people's fault in a simple way, because what's happened, of course, is that the journalism business and the media industry has taken a terrible beating. I'm not just saying this to be polite, but public radio is a bright spot, but of course the Metropolitan Daily newspaper that used to land on your front step is in terrible shape. The Boston Globe, worth only $75 million on the last sale, a great American newspaper. Hardly anyone works there anymore. And I agree with you about the problem. People aren't following the news as much, but I would diagnose it mainly as a problem of the supply rather than the demand.
One of the things we dug into yesterday as we were having this conversation with a philosopher and an economist about things that are maybe broken in our democracy was this big divide between politics at the local level and politics at the national level. And this is something that you talk about in your book. I guess one thing I'd like to address is how local people, how they view Washington, how that might influence whether or not they decide to get involved in anything at the civic level locally. Essentially, the idea that Washington politics informs so much what they think about civic engagement that they just don't want to have any part of it.
Right, right. Yes, I would like people to realize I didn't write a preachy book that says, you know, we all need to engage again because we've forgotten how or something. It's actually a somewhat angry book. And I think that that national politics has suppressed civic engagement, and some deliberately, partly because national politics models civic dialogue and discourse very, very badly. I mean, what could be worse civic education than watching Washington the last 2 weeks? But also because it's all set up in ways that frustrate engagement. I mean, the fact that it costs enormous amounts of money to run for public office and that money comes from a tiny proportion of Americans, that's a pretty big turnoff to civic engagement, even at the local level. So I do blame the powerful for many of these trends.
But of course, then we do tend to sort ourselves in a way in America. We have these big maps whenever it's a presidential election year, and we talk about red states and blue states. And the fact of the matter is, Peter, we really do decide that we're going to live with people, for the most part, who share our thoughts. That can't be good for working across party lines on a civic project when you're surrounding yourself by choice with a bunch of people who agree with you.
I agree. And actually, I'm part of the problem. My family just moved. I just moved with my family to a different community in Massachusetts because basically we liked the local political vibe better. It was, I try to be nonpartisan and neutral in my professional work, but I'm a crunchy liberal in my personal life, and we moved to a crunchy liberal neighborhood. But that's really part of the problem, because the chances that we would have a challenging discussion with someone who disagreed with us on our block is now about zero.
This idea that people don't really have a voice in politics is something that comes up over and over again. We see it periodically, especially in small town Connecticut here, where a vote will come down to really literally one or two votes. And we'll see that, yes, indeed, if you're looking to elect a first selectman in a certain town, your vote really does matter. But in so many other things, people feel as though they don't have a voice in the process. Sometimes that vote seems like the only voice they might have. Talk a bit about that and what you found about people actually feeling like they have some sort of an influence over anything that's going on in their lives.
Well, I mean, we do still have some influence. And I think to some extent, we do have to step up and realize that we actually can make a difference and even have power. And more engaged communities do much better. Their schools are better, their police are better than disengaged communities. But I'm also, at the same time, to go to your question, I'm also sympathetic to the view that we've been disempowered. And it's the money, that I've talked about with campaigns, but it's also the extreme professionalism or professionalization of certain things. So, for example, we have less influence over education as parents or as community members because education is so driven by tests, and tests are written by small numbers of experts, actually including me, because in a different life I'm a civic education kind of expert geek and I write the tests. But a test is a professionally driven, it's literally secret until it's administered to your kids, so you can't have a public discussion about what should be on the test because you're not even allowed to look at it. So in many ways, we have suppressed people's voice.
We're talking today with Peter Levine, whose book is We Are the Ones We Have Been Waiting For, The Promise of Civic Renewal in America. He's from Tufts University, and he joins us today from WGBH in Boston. We're taking your calls at 860-275-7266 about what it means to be civically engaged. A bit later on, we'll be talking more about youth civic engagement in a model UN program. But first, let's go to Sam in New Haven. Hello, Sam. You're on Where We Live.
Hey, so my comment is, for the last couple of years of my life, I've been working in a community organizing or a nonprofit and being involved in politics. And one of the things I found fascinating is the real lack of knowledge I had about local politics until I broke into it, which was about a year after I graduated from college. And I come to it thinking that it's kind of a shame that so many people graduate from high school not having any idea who their state representatives or state senators are who represent them in Hartford. And if they had just known that, politics is local and that's where the most amount of political impact an individual actually can have is, if people just knew that, then they wouldn't just look at Washington and feel jaded and, disappear from the whole process.
Mm. Sam, you raise a great point. Peter Levine, you have a thought about that?
Yeah, I do think, most standards, including probably Connecticut's for civic education, talk about how you need to study local government. But by the time you've covered all the other things you're required to cover, local issues in government tends to drop to the bottom. And to the extent that you talk about it, it tends to be mechanics. For example, county or city in Connecticut, no counties. So how city and town government is organized. Rather than talking about what are the actual issues that are going on in the community around us, that tends to be an afterthought.
It just so happens we have a social studies curriculum specialist from South Windsor Public Schools right here in studio with us. Gregory Frank is also a faculty chair of the World Affairs Council of Connecticut in their Model UN program, and we're going to be talking about that in a moment. But Gregory, first of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And I'm wondering if you might respond to our caller, Sam. He's basically saying we just don't learn enough about local government to even get involved in it. We don't learn enough to actually know that it matters. It means something.
Right. Well, the state of Connecticut does have a requirement that all students in high school have a civics course. Question is how that civics course is actually designed and set up. Normally, it's set up, you learn the three branches of government, the origins of American government, and the state and local piece that Sam talks about is at the end. So for some teachers, they work their way through the curriculum. They're trying to get to civic engagement. They're trying to get kids to get out in the community and engage with, go to a Board of Ed meeting or go to a town council meeting, learn about their local community. And that piece sometimes, unfortunately, gets lost because just the nature of the curriculum, tests, et cetera. And then here you are at the end of the course and you have a few days to spend on that. So it's unfortunate, but I think it's true that we need to get kids more involved on a local level to learn about their government and then in turn, translate that over into something else.
Do you think that students, for the most part, the ones that you come in contact with, are in any way civically engaged or that they can be turned on to civic engagement by just giving them some basic thoughts, some ideas, maybe even a Model UN program? Do you think it's something that can be activated in most young people you work with?
I think it can. I think kids are very, very involved and very busy. They are civically engaged, but they might be involved in a church group, or they might be involved in, Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, sports, etc. Their involvement with local government is tangential at best. It just doesn't happen. And I think there is a way to activate that, but it has to come through the teacher. It has to come through the way the curriculum is designed. It has to change to a point that an emphasis is put on that so that kids get what they need. And right now, unfortunately, in so many places, it's just not happening.
Peter Levine, as you've traced this decline in civic engagement in America, we've already said it in part correlates with the fact that the news media isn't as strong as it once was. We don't let people know what's going on in the world. Do you think, by and large, our education system is somewhat to blame here?
Well, I wouldn't want to load all the responsibility on the education system. And what Greg was just talking about is a perfect example of how our educators are usually actually trying to do their best. And I work a lot with educators, and they really are trying to do their best. But it is true that we've had waves of education reform over the last 20 years, mostly coming from Washington, that have transformed our schools in many different ways, and no one in any of that has paid any attention to civics. For example, in No Child Left Behind, passed in 2003, there's just nothing literally about civics at all. So it has been an afterthought, and especially in high-stakes testing places, and especially in stressed urban public schools, because those are the places where they're most worried about the kids failing the standardized tests, and so the first place that they're going to cut civics.
Let's go to Dick, who's calling from Brantford. Hello there. You're on Where We Live.
I was taken by your guest's remark about designing boards for the 21st century. It seems to me, to draw on my experience as a member of several boards, that one of the challenges is that after a time, board membership becomes entrenched. There's a graying of the board. But at the same time, there's changes in the executive or paid staff for the board, and the mission and original purpose of the board is gradually recedes over the horizon, and it's the original purposes are lost. The solution, in my thinking, is at least evaluation of the board's performance with specific relationship to its original and chartered goals. I'll listen to your comment, if any, on the radio.
Well, Dick, thank you very much for that. And Peter Levine, as he talks about the graying of boards, people who are civically engaged, they get involved at the local level, and they continue on in that process for a very long time. That is something that we certainly do see in an awful lot of communities, especially here in Connecticut.
Right, and so one of our main goals and duties as active citizens is to make sure that we're bringing the next generation on board. Otherwise, the future of our democracy is doomed. So if your board is getting gray, and I'm gray myself, you need to make sure that you're encouraging the next generation to come on board. The next generation is actually in many ways very appealing when you look at surveys and even test scores. They have a lot to offer. They're not slackers. Some of them are. But on the whole, I think they're a pretty appealing generation. But if you don't make something like a board welcoming into them, if you don't even ask them about it or tell them about it or invite them to come, then they're not going to show up, and then we're going to have a real crisis.
When we come back from our break, we are going to be talking about getting the next generation involved. We're going to be talking about Model UN programs here in Connecticut, and we'll continue our conversation with Peter Levine, whose book is We Are the Ones We Have Been Waiting For, The Promise of Civic Renewal in America. We'd like to hear from you. Do you see yourself as an active member of your community? Do you think young people need to be more involved? How can you get them involved? 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about getting people involved in democracy, in debate, getting them civically engaged. The author Peter Levine has charted a steady decline in civic engagement starting in the 1970s, trying to figure out what to do about it. Yesterday we had a big conversation about our democracy being broken. Well, how do we get more people civically engaged? 860-275-7266 if you want to join the conversation. We have a call here from Lisa. Hi there, Lisa. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I think the issue that I really wanted to make sure was part of this framing of people's civic engagement is also just the inordinate pressure in American society of people's work schedules, and also how little supports we have for the family care issues. So, you know, people are now, lots of people now are not only feeling a lot of pressure to work a lot of hours all the time, but they are also have very few supports to help them with childcare, elder care, and other kinds of care issues. You know, and I actually do research in this area, and I also teach in this area, and I find that when I interview people and talk to students, young people, I know you're particularly interested in, They express a lot of desire to get involved in their communities or in larger issues, but they simply have no choices because of the economic pressures and the work pressures.
Mm. Well, Lisa, first of all, you bring up some great points. And before I ask for a comment from Peter, I just want to say we also got a tweet from Kevin who says it seems harder to be civically engaged when our work in Connecticut is usually in a random suburban office park that you drive to. And then Josh tweets us, does more widespread economic hardship curtail involvement? More people struggling equals less time for civic participation. Seems like all those thoughts are kind of tying together, Peter.
Yeah, no, those are great, great comments and troubling issues. One thing I'd highlight, I agree with everything those three people said, and there's, of course, a big gender implication here because it's still predominantly women who deal with the child care issues. And there's my colleagues at Circle at Tufts University have really been studying young women's political leadership and civic leadership. And we find that even though young women are better informed and more civically active when they're college students, there's a tremendous drop-off in their kind of career pathways in civic life. So they're much less likely to run for office, even local office. They're much less likely to be leaders of nonprofits. And I think, I mean, we haven't really proved it, but I think a major reason is that they're shouldering the burden for childcare, especially as young adults. So the whole question of what happens between 25 and 35, if you're very busy trying to make a living, bringing up kids and female, is really worth talking about.
We're going to get to some more of your phone calls as we talk about the issue of civic engagement on the show at 860-275-7266. In just a moment, I want to welcome into our conversation, as we met before, Gregory Frank, who's a social studies curriculum specialist for South Windsor Public Schools. He's also faculty chair of the World Affairs Council of Connecticut. They do a model UN program, which we'll be talking about. Alexandra Buda is here. She's secretary general of UConn's student-run model UN program. Alexandra, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you've been listening into this conversation. First, before I get you talking about the UN program, what about this sort of stands out to you? What about this conversation resonates? You were just talking about the fact that essentially in Peter's research and his colleagues' research, a lot of young women are able to be actively involved in school, and then sometimes they're not able to be as actively involved later on in life. What does all this say to you?
It's a very interesting conversation. I wanted to highlight the family impact. I know for me, one of the reasons why I'm as civically engaged as I am is because of my family. Both my parents are very heavily involved in the community where I live, and I think that has had a huge impact on my life and my own involvement. Very interesting conversation about, in terms of the future, being a young female and what that means for like having a family and work and my involvement in the community. We'll see what happens. I hope to somehow have an influence in some sort of civically engaged career path, and we'll see.
So when we hear about this lack of civic engagement in across our population, but also amongst young people, is that something that sounds about right to you? I mean, do you feel like among your peers, you are more involved in what's going on than a lot of the rest of them are?
I would have to say yes. Among the UConn community, among the group that I'm involved in, yes, especially. So currently at UConn, I'm a director of an alternative break, and I got the trip is to Costa Rica over winter break. And for example, we received 60 applications for the trip, and over 58 were female, 2 were male. Not sure what that says, but I just thought to bring up this gender difference in this conversation.
That's very interesting. One of the things that we were talking about is whether or not people know what's going on, read the newspaper, really feel like they know how town government works and what they might actually be able to do to change something. At this stage in your life, do you feel like, aside from working on a model UN program and being civically engaged on campus, do you feel like you could have some sort of influence in the town where you live, or that you could actually get involved in some way in a political movement that would be meaningful and would actually get something done?
I feel like the awareness, the knowledge and the education level I have, but the awareness of how to participate and how to engage is not there at all. I think from what Mr. Frank was saying before, that the civics class, the end, deals with the local level. I feel like I never that wasn't emphasized enough and that needs to be more emphasized in the future.
Maybe, Gregory Frank, you can tell us a bit about some of the changes in South Windsor Civics Program, a little bit more about what you folks are trying to do to change all this.
Well, we're trying to take a traditional curriculum, which has generally meant, you know, it's not state mandated other than the fact that you have to have a civics curriculum. And then it's up to the individual town to design that. We do it on the junior level, and it's been a course that, you know, is fine, and teachers work very hard at it to make it engaging for kids. But it generally is kind of a march through, you know, the origins of the Constitution, Bill of Rights, and then directly into branches of government, and then it's Thanksgiving, and then the holidays come, and then we never, you know, the state and local piece typically gets lost. So what we're trying to do is redesign the curriculum in a way right now where that emphasis, where it doesn't have to be sort of a historical march through the creation of government. It could be more rooted in what the kids want to do and also how they can get involved on a local level. And it takes a lot to redesign a curriculum. We worked a lot of teachers. We worked all summer really to get it in place for this year, and we're going to see how it goes.
And there's some more questions I want to ask you about this, especially getting kids involved in things that are meaningful in their lives and how that sometimes rubs up against the needs or the wishes of a school administration. But I'm going to put that thought on hold because I want to welcome into the conversation somebody who's calling us who I've actually had a conversation, a rolling conversation about this issue with for years. A few years ago, Ralph Nader and I went to the high school that's in my town in Winsted, Northwest Regional, and we had a conversation with kids about this very issue, and Ralph Nader is joining us today from Winsted. Ralph, good to hear from you again. Thanks so much for calling in.
Oh, it's a wonderful program, and everybody should read Peter Levine's book. I want to just give a few quick examples of success here. About 15 years ago, a fifth grade girl in Salt Lake City walked into her class and said to her teacher, "I think there's a waste dump a few blocks away." Well, nobody believed her until they examined it, and it was a block waste covered by shrubbery and long time forgotten. Make a long story short, the teacher made the discovery part of her teaching course. They testified locally. They got the mayor to clean up the dump. They then were invited to testify at the state legislature on a Superfund law. She was so excited, the teacher. She writes a book called Kids in Social Action. It's Free Spirit Press in Minneapolis, St. Paul, two editions. And the nub of her excitement was learn by doing in the community, get the attention of adults who praise you, and get something done. In Winsted, the community lawyer, Charlene Lavoie, every year has a Freedom of Information Law a contest and a social studies course here at the high school, and they can choose two different routes. One, they can write an essay on trying to persuade a foreign government to have a Freedom of Information Act. You know, without information is the currency of democracy. And or file a actual Freedom of Information request to a Connecticut state agency or a federal agency on a health and safety issue that matters to them. And the winners, there are three winners. They get a prize, $100, $75, $50. And they learn an important skill for civic engagement, which is getting information out of government files, meat and poultry inspection reports, for example, and so on. So we shouldn't over-bureaucratize the teaching of civic education. It does require some adult supervision outside the schools. It does require touring your own hometown so you know where the drinking water is being purified or what some of the natural artifacts are. And go down to the local courtroom or a nearby courtroom, show up with the children at the town meetings. I ask college students, how many of you have ever been to a mall or a McDonald's or a Starbucks? And of course, all the hands go up. And I say, how many of you have ever been to a courtroom as a spectator? How many of you have ever been to a town meeting? And how many of you have ever visited a prison as a spectator? Almost no hands go up. So the parents, as well as the teachers, have got to give these students empirical experience in the community where they meet real people. They get complimented for what they're doing, and they do adult things as part of their education.
Well, I think this idea, and Ralph, as always, great to talk to you, and thank you so much for calling in. This idea of meeting real people, Peter Levine, and actually doing real work, this is something that Ralph has been talking about for a number of years. It's one thing to do a classroom exercise. It's another thing to go do a Freedom of Information Act request about something that may be a problem in your town and actually try to solve that problem. He's talking about something that's very specific that could get students engaged.
Yeah. Well, first of all, hearing Ralph Nader plug my book on radio is you know, makes my week. But and I'm glad he brought up the bright side. I mean, he started with a story, and it's a story of a successful civic education and also successful civic work because they actually solved a problem. And, you know, that's not so very rare. At least let's accentuate the positive. There is a lot going on. And he pointed out that we don't want to over-bureaucratize civic education. I'm actually kind of glad that Connecticut doesn't have a high-stakes civics test and does give a lot of flexibility to school districts to design their curriculum because they can actually do the kind of thing he's talking about. But I'll just throw out one obstacle, which is a lot of parents are very suspicious nowadays of civic education in schools. They think it's got a strong ideological bias and that their kids will be somehow infected by that. We found that literally one quarter of all high school government teachers in America think that their parents of their students would object if politics was discussed in their high school government class. Right? Mm-hmm. So high school government class, and you talk about politics, the parents will object. And that is an obstacle. So I think the main reason that more teachers don't do what Ralph Nader described is that they're afraid of the parents.
Wow. And, well, does that sound about right to you, Gregory Frank?
I wouldn't say afraid, mindful of the parents. You have to know that there are certain things that are kind of the third rail that you don't want to touch. And here you are in a civics class, in a government class. You want to discuss politics, but as a teacher, you want to appear absolutely 100% neutral on these issues, present the kids. But even sometimes in a debate, you know, a kid will take a stand, whether they're parroting the parents or not, and they'll take a very hardline issue. And is that influencing other kids? You know, this is one of these things where you want to get kids to have an opinion and take a stand, but you also don't want them to, you know, completely influence or dominate a class and tell other students what to think and that sort of thing. So it is difficult. It isn't like talking about a historical issue, perhaps, where you can be more neutral. You know, politics are heated and the debate can be heated as well.
Well, we're going to get to the debate and making an argument at a Model UN in just a moment, but I wanted to get back to this thing, and I think Ralph Nader gave us a little segue into this, that sometimes the things that students would argue for the most vehemently, the things that they would get most civically involved in, are policies in their school. Address policies, policies having to do with video surveillance in the schools. And those are exactly the sorts of things that school districts just don't want kids talking about an awful lot of the time. Maybe you can talk about overcoming this barrier, because if you want to get kids civically engaged, have them start talking about something that matters to them, but then schools say, but you can't talk about that because that would get us in trouble.
Well, there are school policies in place where there are certain things that, unfortunately, you know, to get kids involved, to get them to rally to a cause, could lead to problems, perhaps. So, you know, getting students involved and getting them concerned with an issue is great. Once it gets political or they're having a protest against, you know, a lunchroom policy or a dress code or something like that, then you're running afoul of the school district. And there are certain things in place for school safety and all the rest. And you can't. So you're constantly sort of, how do you get kids involved, but maybe don't push them too far in terms of, you know, getting them on board on some issue, which, you know, could get them in trouble.
And then, Alexandria, you get to the university level, and you are supposed to be outspoken and speak your mind and organize around a specific issue. When it comes to issues on, say, the UConn college campus, do you feel as though students actually are allowed to have a voice, talk back to the administration in a way that actually is helpful?
I think that's an interesting point. Yes, I believe that you can generally, there's different venues and different routes that you can go about expressing your opinion and saying what you believe and getting together with other kids who have that same opinion. There is a lot of there's some backlash if you go against the grain. But I think that there's many students at UConn, and there's plenty of people who will agree with you or will disagree with you. There's everyone.
I've certainly done some work with student newspapers at the college level, and sometimes it's very, very difficult to get student newspaper reporters in to see the administration. And then if the administration says something that they don't really want printed, they are sometimes likely to talk to the newspaper to not get that printed. And it's one of those chilling effects that I don't think any of us necessarily want to see as we try to get children more civically engaged all throughout their lives. We're talking with Alexandra Buda, who's Secretary General of UConn's student-run Model UN program. We'll be walking through that program coming up next. Gregory Frank also works with the Connecticut World Affairs Council's Model UN program. Peter Levine is here from WGBH in Boston. His book is called We Are the Ones We Have Been Waiting For, The Promise of Civic Renewal in America. We'll take more of your phone calls coming up right after this break, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about civic engagement on the program. We spoke with some UConn student members of the Model UN program. We asked them what they felt students gained from this program and how the program has affected them.
Some of the students don't do their research, but the ones that do really gain an understanding of how the world works and how to look through another person's eyes, another country's eyes, and examine an issue from a different perspective.
I feel like I've gained a global perspective over certain gray areas of the map, and thinking in terms of, like, if you're Russia, you're thinking in terms of what they think of the world. It's like an Eastern perspective instead of a Western perspective, and it's really good to get that variety.
There's a certain amount of civic engagement, I think, that you can get from Model UN, but some of the most valuable skills are the learning how to work with people who just really don't agree with you. And just learning to stand up and speak and stand firm on your positions, it's something that you absolutely cannot go without.
I mean, one of the biggest things that I saw an increase of was their public speaking ability. They were really able to work on communicating better and more effectively. Also, I think it broadens their perspectives a lot. It's a kind of political activism where they're the first line. They're able to really vocalize their opinions, and once they do their research really well, they kind of go into depth and really understand the political process, especially of the UN, which is very complex.
Our intern, Garrett Connolly, who produced today's show, talked with UConn students John Myers, Chris Baker, and Emil Magid. Alex, who has been speaking with us, who is part of this program, I want to bring you back in and talk a little bit about what Model UN really does and what it's done for you.
So at the University of Connecticut, we put on a conference for over 350 high school students this coming November. It's an annual conference, and we have over 100, it's staffed by over 100 UConn students. For me, I've been involved in for the past 4 years, and I've seen sort of the changes between the first day of the conference and the third day of the conference in these high school students. It's really incredible what they experience and the changes that they face in terms of their knowledge and their public speaking ability and really they embrace their country's position, and that they learn that every country has an equal say and that it's equally important.
Gregory Frank, maybe you can explain a little bit about how this works. So essentially, students are taking positions based on the countries that they're given. So they have to learn an awful lot about not only their home country, but the other countries, the topic at hand, and they need to make a kind of a cogent argument. Tell me about how this all works.
Well, it begins, you know, students select their own countries. I know Alexandra is with the UConn Model UN. I'm with the World Affairs Council of Connecticut's Model UN, which is a separate. There are lots of different Model UNs you can go to. There's a national. There's a Yale Model UN, Harvard Model UN. There are lots in the region that you can go to. In our Model UN, the students pick a country, and then they begin the research. And then one of the exciting parts of our program is that students actually travel to New York City, and they meet with their delegates, with the ambassador from that country. Last year I was at the Kenyan mission. The year before that, I went to the Albanian mission. I mean, it's really interesting in terms of what experience the kids get. And then from that point, they begin to form arguments, which they write into a resolution. Then they debate that with other students in committee when we actually have the Model UN, which we do at the University of Hartford. So it's a really exciting thing. I would echo everything Alexandra said about, you know, students learning and from their freshman year to their senior year, just really progressing in terms of skills, public debate, research, working with other students in committee. It's just – it's an exciting thing to watch.
And this idea of public debate is really interesting, Alexandra, that it's not just about writing down on a piece of paper what I'm going to say. But when you get into a debate, it's about listening to what the other people are saying and translating that. Talk about building those skills because, frankly, having taught at the college level for some time, that's not always something college students are all that great at. They can be great at presenting the paper, but then you ask them a question and they kind of freeze up. So this is, a big skill.
So in the debate, we use what's called parliamentary procedure to effectively communicate. And essentially, it's the way that the actual UN uses to discuss, as well as the Senate and other large organizations. And it's great because it allows for each country to have an equal say. So they get put on this list that progresses, and they motion to make debates. They motion for caucuses. And it's very equally representative.
This idea is something that has been going on for a number of years. And Peter Levine, I'm wondering if you could chime in. Do you see programs like the Model UN being something that can work to get young people involved in a little bit more civically, maybe even at the local level?
Absolutely. I mean, we put it in the category of simulations. So you're not really the ambassador of Albania to the UN. You're pretending you are. But it's really valuable. And there are a lot of simulations, including nowadays some interesting games and online simulations. The great thing is you can structure that process so that it really brings out high-level skills. So you really have to, for example, use parliamentary procedure. I also like real-world action where you're actually taking on actual problems. But, you know, they're both good. And actually, I love the visit to the UN, to the real UN, because that's a perfect example of kind of a hybrid. They're pretending to be the ambassador of Albania to the UN, but they're meeting the real ambassador or some representative of Albania. And that, of course, is a real world activity because you're going and you're actually asking questions of a real person, which is also a civic skill.
And this sometimes results in students asking questions of the ambassador. The ambassador would answer in a way that the students might see as not entirely correct or not entirely truthful. I mean, this has probably got to happen all the time. They're there to do a job, and you get a chance to see firsthand that someone's trying to spin a particular story.
Well, those, yeah, I mean, if I were, yeah,
sorry,
definitely, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, Gregory. Yeah.
Well, those conversations are very rich, though. I mean, students obviously have to assess how honest and forthcoming the ambassador or assistants can be, and so that's part of the process as well. Many times, you know, if it's a country that's, I want to say, friendly to the United States or we have a good relationship with, you get different answers than you would from a North Korean delegation or, you know, you get different types of answers and the kids then have to step back. We have great students, so they're, you know, they're polite when they're there. But once they leave, you know, there are great conversations on the buses home where they're like, do you think we were getting a straight answer on that? Did we get a real assessment of what's going on in that country? Is that really their opinion or not?
Well, now, as I was talking with Garrett as we were putting together the show, one thing that I know I wanted to ask you, and maybe you can weigh in as well, Alexandra, is, you know, in Peter's book and in the conversation we had yesterday, it seems pretty clear that, say, the way Washington works isn't the best model right now for civic engagement, for civic debate. Some people would suggest that the UN isn't either, that the United Nations in and of itself is a body that doesn't have the influence that it could in a lot of ways, that the speechifying that happens in New York every once in a while doesn't really amount to all that much. Gregory, I guess I'm wondering if you can talk about how much you're able with the students to talk through this idea of what the UN really is, what it can actually do, and what all this debate ends up getting us in the end.
Well, the UN is imperfect. We know that. But we also know that it's trying to do something great and noble, and that is to, you know, get countries together and to have a discourse. And I think, you know, students understand that the influence and the impact of the UN around the world is perhaps not as much as a sovereign state could do on its own. But at other times, you know, that cooperation between countries can really go a long way. And, you know, I find that students, they go into it with their eyes open. You know, it isn't a Pollyanna-ish view of the UN that it's a perfect entity. But in looking at their topics and their committees, they understand things on a complex level, you know, multivalent level, where they're learning, you know, how this issue operates in the world and how it impacts their country, but also a region. So I think they understand that point, that the UN is not perfect, but they, through in their own way, I hope, are kind of internalizing, because a lot of my students have gone on to international studies, political science, history. They want to continue that process. So if they see that something's not great, maybe they can improve it on their own.
Actually fix it. Alexandria, do you have some thoughts about that?
I do. I just want to echo what Mr. Frank said about internalizing it. This, over the past 3 years, I've noticed in the conferences that I've been a part of that it's sort of not that necessarily that the conversation ends after the conference, but that there's no sort of like activism push. And this year I am working to bring sort of a social justice component into the conference to see if we can do some simulations or some activities where the kids can reflect on their own identities and sort of how they want to make a difference in the world.
And make a difference in what way? Give me an example.
For example, to be engaged locally, an NGO, a community kitchen, a community shelter, some sort of – I want to make them passionate about an issue that pertains to their local community and give them sort of the tools – or the knowledge that they can do something about it.
I want to get to a quick phone call. Rose is in Plainville. Hi, Rose. Go ahead.
Hi. There seem to be certain issues that the administrators don't want to let the students protest. Maybe these are issues that should be brought up. Maybe the students are right. And I think that when children are young or students are young, it shouldn't be assumed that they naturally will protest something that's that they shouldn't protest. I think it's a process where, you know, they don't suddenly reach adulthood and become wise. It has to be a process. So I'm totally in favor of letting the students say what they have to say.
Well, and Rose, thank you very much. Peter Levine, we just have about a minute left, and we've gotten through this entire conversation here, and we've talked almost not at all about the technological changes that this generation are grappling with. In a minute or so, maybe you can talk through what your findings are in your book about the fact that right now students are getting together and engaging in a way that you and I never could have imagined.
Yeah, no, they're the leaders of using the new technologies. They all use them, including very disadvantaged kids. They do talk about current events and issues online, especially with social media. But I think the great concern is the one that you brought up earlier about self-segregation, about just talking to people who are like you, which is particularly easy online. So we have to teach kids to interact with people who are different from themselves, which I think to some extent they want to do. They say they want to do it, but they don't know how.
Peter Levine's book is We Are the Ones We Have Been Waiting For. He's a professor at Tufts, and he joined us today from WGBH in Boston. Thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks also to Alexandra Buda, who's the Secretary General of UConn's student-run Model UN program. Sounds like a great program, and we really appreciate you coming in and taking some time.
Thank you.
And thanks to Gregory Frank, who's faculty chair for the World Affairs Council of Connecticut, who we work with quite often on our program. He's also a social studies curriculum specialist for South Windsor Public Schools. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
You can continue this conversation that we've been having for the last few days about democracy online. Go to WNPR.org, and you can look for today's program page and add some of your comments. Where We Live is produced by Tucker Ives with Betsy Kaplan and Heather Brandon. The senior producer is Katie Talarski. Thanks to Garrett Connolly for producing today's show. I'm John Dankosky. Have a great weekend.